The third case for oral argument this morning is Harold Stordsby, appellant, versus Walter Buchholz, appellee. For the appellant, Mr. Stordsby is Mr. Stephen Christensen, an attorney from Deadwood, and for the appellee Buchholz is Mr. Dylan Loyalty, an attorney from Spearfish. There have been two disqualifications in this case. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Sean O'Brien, a judge from the First Circuit, to sit in his place, and Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Mark Barnett, a circuit judge from the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in her place. Mr. Christensen, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court. It's one thing to change the rules before the game is played, or perhaps even while the game is being played. It is another thing to change the rules years after the game has been played and to reverse the outcome. That is fundamentally unfair, and it is unconstitutional. Harold Stordsby, with the indulgence of the court, I will refer to as Harold, married Linda in 1966. In July 1971, Linda began working for Black Hill State University and began making monthly contributions to her retirement account. In July 1971, she designated in writing her clear intention regarding who should receive her retirement proceeds in the event of her death. She filled out the written beneficiary designation and named Harold. In June 1975, Linda and Harold divorced. Nothing in the findings of fact or conclusions of law or the judgment which adopted those made any specific reference to the retirement plan. Linda married Appellee Buchholz in October 1979. 36 months later, she quit her employment at Black Hill State University and stopped making monthly contributions to the plan. From a statistical point of view, Linda contributed to the plan for 47 months while married to Harold. She contributed to the plan for 51 months while she was single. She made the least contributions, 36 months, while married to Appellee Buchholz. South Dakota Retirement Service planned to pay the benefits to Harold. Linda had 31 years to change her beneficiary. She didn't, and SDRS believed her intention, as expressed in the beneficiary designation, form controlled.
How much was the, I'm just curious, what was the monthly benefit?
I can't tell you, but 200 and something, it strikes me.
Just a minute, Mr. Christensen. Court would note that Mr. Hubbard is in the audience and is the attorney for the retirement system. Just to clarify, counsel, this is not an appearance, is it? You just came to listen?
No, Your Honor. SDRS has no position on this particular issue.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. Sorry for the interruption, Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Buchholz objected to SDRS's determination that they were going to pay the money to Harold and brought this action. The trial court ruled from the bench that 29A2804 trumped her written expression of intent. Our primary argument is that the application of a 1995 statute to contractual obligations formed in 1971 is fundamentally unfair and unconstitutional. However, before getting there, I have several things to say about 29A2804 and a companion provision found in 29A8101B. First and foremost, this redistribution statute was tucked into the Uniform Probate Code when it was considered by the legislature and enacted with little or no discussion. I know from practicing law for 32 years that few, if any, of the legislators were conversant and familiar with all of the ramifications of the Uniform Probate Code. It was a uniform law. Uniformity is good. And if it's going to lower the cost of probate, then it must really be good. I can't tell you how many legislatures knew that within this Uniform Probate Code was a divorce property redistribution statute. But I can make a reasonable estimate of how many laymen were aware of this. That many, maybe a couple more. Up until 1995, this court's decision in Girard v. Pardum was the law in the state. Federal common law in the circuit was to the same effect. The circumstances surrounding Girard are extremely analogous to the facts of this case. It involved insurance proceeds versus retirement benefits, but that's really a distinction without a difference. In Girard, the husband had granted his first, had designated his first wife as beneficiary of an insurance policy offered at work. They subsequently divorced, same as this case, and he remarried. When he died, his first wife was still the named beneficiary. The second wife claimed the proceeds, essentially because, after all, she was his wife at that time, and because the general language in the divorce decree could be interpreted as settling everything, all the rights and responsibilities between the parties. That same argument could be made in this case because there's similar general language found in one conclusion of law. But this court found that the first wife would receive the beneficiaries, the money, because she was the named beneficiary and because the general rule was that unless specifically altered in the language of the divorce, his intention as expressed in the written designation controlled. And as I've already stated, the federal common law reached the same conclusion with the same analysis. And although that's not binding on the court, it's certainly something that the court can consider. Then came the Uniform Probate Code in 1995 and a rather murky statute, I submit, changed the rules. Let's start with 29A2804, which is the statute which the trial court relied upon. And that's found on page 12 of my brief. It reads, except as provided by the express terms of a governing instrument, a court order, or a contract relating to division of marital estate made between the divorced individuals before, after the marriage, divorce, or annulment, the divorce or annulment of a marriage revokes any irrevocable dispositions or appointment of property made by a divorced individual to a former spouse in a governing instrument, and any disposition or appointment created by law or in a governing instrument to the relative of the divorced individual's former spouse, etc., etc. What we start with in this statute is the exceptions, one of which is the express terms of the governing instrument. I have to believe that the legislature was not trying to trump everybody's intentions. You could have a spouse under any number of scenarios that wishes to keep his ex-spouse on a particular insurance plan, whether they have children together and he wants to make sure that there's some money there, whether they're still friends, as is the case with Harold and Linda in this case. So that would be one major exception if there were express terms in a governing instrument. Another exemption would be if there was a court order that dealt with it specifically. A third is a contract relating to the division of marital estate. So in looking at the statute, it's been our position from the beginning that there was a governing instrument. There was a beneficiary designation form. It was filled out by Linda, and it expressly provided, to the contrary, that my insurance, my pension benefits are going to go to Harold. If you also look at 29A8101B, we submit it gets more confusing. That states, this code applies to governing instruments executed by decedents dying on or after July 1, 1995, no matter when executed. Any rule of construction or presumption provided in this code applies to governing instruments executed before July 1, 1995, unless there is a clear intention of a contrary intent. And again, I have to believe that the legislature is saying some people inadvertently don't change their life insurance beneficiary. Some people don't change their pension plan beneficiary through inadvertence. That can happen. And if it does happen, we're going to decide that it goes to your new wife because it was just inadvertence. If there's a clear intention that it goes someplace else, then that's what's going to control. So we think applying the statute and the language of the statute, Harold should prevail. But leaving aside the less than clear wording of the statute, appellant respectfully contends that application of this 1995 statute to negate Linda's clear intention and contractual arrangement with SDRS made in writing over 24 years previously, wherein she contracted with SDRS to pay her benefit to Harold Storsby should she die, is an unconstitutional violation of Article 6, Section 12 of the South Dakota Constitution. The Eighth Circuit, in the case that I cite in my reply brief, Whirlpool, talks about cases that they're very analogous to this situation. In Whirlpool, James and Darlene Ritter were married in 1972. James designated Darlene as his beneficiary in a group life insurance policy offered through his employer. 2 years later, Oklahoma passed a redistribution statute very analogous to ours. Basically, it said that for anyone who died divorced from his designated beneficiary, the designation was revoked. I have quoted that statute in my reply brief, and it reads, if a party to a contract with the power to designate the beneficiary of any death benefit dies after being divorced from the beneficiary named to receive such death benefit in contract, all provisions in such contract in favor of decedent's former spouse are hereby revoked. That's essentially what our statute says. They're both arriving at the same result. The Eighth Circuit held that when Oklahoma legislature changed the rules for interpreting insurance contracts and applied the new rules to completed transactions, it affected the fundamental and pejorative change in the very essence of those contracts, which it does by common sense. The Eighth Circuit noted, the Oklahoma law, insofar as it is applied retrospectively, which is important. I'm not talking about from 1995 on, this is how the game will be played. But the Oklahoma law, insofar as it is applied retrospectively, is inappropriate in light of its intended purpose and underlying rationale. While it may be true that some individuals, given a choice, would prefer to guarantee the financial security of their new family instead of their former family, this is certainly not a universal truth. Thus, while it may be true that had James thought about his life insurance policy, he would have changed it to name Diana, his new wife, as beneficiary, it's equally possible that he made a conscious choice to leave Darlene as the named beneficiary. This is simply too much Big Brother in this case. And we respectfully submit that this court should reverse the trial court, either on the basis that the statute, which is ambiguous when interpreted, would call for Harold to receive the proceeds because there was a clear indication that that's what Linda wanted, or alternatively, that we're not going to take a 1995 statute and make it change important contractual obligations entered in 1971. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Mr. Wild, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dylan Wild, and I'm representing the appellee, Walter Buchholz, in this matter. Basically, the court is going to be asked to decide whether SDCL Section 29A2-804, South Dakota's redesignation statute, is applicable in this case, will effectuate a revocation of the beneficiary designation in the name of Mr. Storsby to obtain a divorce from the plan participant 31 years ago. The result of that would then allow the proceeds in the retirement plan to go to the estate and thus to the sole beneficiary of that estate, my client, Walter Buchholz, who had been married to the plan participant for 27 years upon her death. The first argument that Mr. Storley brings is that the Girard versus Pardum in the federal common law, which has similar holdings, is applicable to this case. That case and those similar federal common law cases basically state the general rule at the time was that a divorce does not ordinarily affect a beneficiary designation. However, on the adoption of the UPC in 1995, the legislature trumped that general rule by applying the redesignation statute. Now, in South Dakota, the law is a divorce does revoke a beneficiary designation unless three exceptions are invoked. Here, none of the exceptions are invoked. Mr. Storsby's contention that the express terms of the governing instrument is invoked, this doesn't make sense when applied to the statute. As stated in his brief, he believes that the express terms that invoke the exception is that the policy identifies the plan. There's a plan owner, and there's a plan beneficiary. Well, you need all of those to invoke the redesignation statute to suggest that those same requirements to invoke the statute also invoke the exception would nullify the statute and it would never apply. Surely that's an absurd construction of the statute, which this court has stated is not to be undertaken. Furthermore, as far as the retroactive effect of the statute, there is only a presumption that statutes are not to apply retroactively. That can be overcome by the legislature's express intent. Here, as Mr. Christensen pointed out, SDCL Section 29A-8-101, the effective date statute of the UPC, expressly states that governing instruments shall apply, or the UPC shall apply to governing instruments executed by a decedent dying on or after July 1st, 1995, no matter when executed. That no matter when executed is clearly the legislature's express intent that that the UPC, including the redesignation statute, is to apply to contracts or retirement plans entered into before the adoption of the UPC. Furthermore, there is no vested right impaired here, as at the time that the UPC was adopted, Mr. Storsby was only a beneficiary. Thus, as a beneficiary, he has no vested rights in the contract. He merely has an expectation interest, which this court clearly stated in Girard v. Pardon.
Talking about that Girard case, if I can just interrupt you, you state on page 11 of your brief that and you quote the Girard case, and you say the South Dakota legislature determined that the general rule in the Girard case was incorrect. by adopting the Uniform Probate Code. Now, why do you think, why do you make that statement that that the general rule was incorrect?
Because what the South Dakota legislature did is basically it flipped that general rule. Before, a divorce was not considered to affect a beneficiary designation, except in instances where there are expressed terms in a divorce decree or a property settlement agreement. Here, in the redesignation statute, is completely opposite. That general rule is no longer applicable. Rather, the general rule now is that a divorce is going to affect a beneficiary designation, except for the express terms of, in a divorce decree, a contract, or in the governing instruments.
Well, my question was, your term incorrect. I mean, just because they do something different than the general rule, does that mean that it wasn't correct beforehand?
I think, you mean whether it was correct at the time that the judiciary...
Correct. Do you think the legislature knew what they were doing? I mean, it appears to Mr. Christensen's argument is that the legislature didn't know what they were doing at the time.
Well, I think that it's a well-settled law that statutes are presumed to be constitutional and valid unless proven otherwise by beyond a reasonable doubt. I think that it is presumed that this statute is valid, that they did know what they were doing in enacting this statute. I think that's part of the presumption that is given to the legislature. I think the legislature's enactment of this shows basically the public's intention that when individuals divorce, they're sufficiently unhappy with each other that neither of them plan on, having any property distributed to them upon their death. And I don't think that that just changed overnight. I have a feeling that when people divorced back in 1982, they still didn't expect that any property would be distributed to their ex-spouses upon their death. I think the legislature realized that and, as such, put this statute in place. In regards to back to the retroactive application of the statute argument, again, the legislature in the effective date statute expressly says no matter when executed, has to apply beforehand. There isn't an impairment of a vested right, therefore, it can be applied retroactively as the legislature intended. Now we get to the contrast clause argument. I've argued in my brief that this argument should not be considered by this court. If you look at the trial court, or the hearing court transcript on the motion for summary judgment, on page 6, Mr. Christensen states, there's a constitutional issue. For appellate purposes, I want to make sure that that's in the record. Goes on to state that Article 6, Section 12 of the South Dakota Constitution states that no ex post facto law or law impairing the obligation of contract shall be passed. After that, he then goes into an argument on the equities, and then he goes back into analogizing the Girard case. There is no authority given to Judge Johnson. There is no definition of the issues, what actually was impaired. There is nothing there for the judge really to consider. When you look at page 9, Judge Johnson then states, I didn't realize you were raising a constitutional issue. You hadn't until this morning, had you, Mr. Christensen? No. On rebuttal, I also stated I wasn't prepared for a constitutional issue. I didn't know one was being brought. thereafter, I explained that it appears to me that he's arguing that Mr. Storsby's contractual rights were impaired. If you look at the contract clause case law, basically there's a two-part test. The court has to find that there's a substantial impairment of contractual relationship. And in that first part of that test, there's three components. The first is that there must be a contractual relationship. Well, numerous courts have found that when you are merely a named beneficiary, you do not have a vested interest, and thus you do not satisfy that first component. If you look at the Lincoln Benefit Life Company versus Heinz case, the District Court of Minnesota stated to establish a contractual relationship, A party must demonstrate that the contract gave her a vested interest, not merely an expectancy. Thereafter, that court decided that because the beneficiary only had an expectation interest, they did not have a vested right, and thus that first component was not satisfied. Thus, that was the only real issue that was able to be discussed at the trial court or at the circuit court level. After I made the argument that Mr. Storsby did not have a contractual relationship, I made a couple other arguments to rebut other contentions made by Mr. Christensen. Then the court said, on page 14, Mr. Christensen, do you have anything further? Rather than stating yes, there's also a question of whether Linda's contractual rights were impaired. He said no. The court then granted our motion for summary judgment and denied Mr. Storsby's motion for summary judgment. What I'm trying to say is, at the most, the only issue regarding the contract clause that can be brought in front of this court on this case is whether Mr. Storsby's contractual rights were impaired. Clearly, they were not, according to well-established case law, according to the test of the contract clause. Now, for the first time on appeal, he's trying to argue that Linda's contractual rights were impaired. That is a constitutional issue, which in Kirby, City of Sioux Falls, in 1997 South Dakota case, this court stated that constitutional issues are, I'm sorry, it's Kern versus City of Sioux Falls, where it stated that constitutional issues are procedural, not jurisdictional. Thus, they cannot be raised for the first time on appeal. But yet, we're here today arguing whether Linda's contractual rights have been impaired.
Is there any real prejudice to you there? I mean, we look at those questions purely de novo anyway. No matter what the trial court would have said or about the issue, we would still examine it, and you've had a chance to brief it. So what prejudice is there to you now?
You know, I did brief it. However, I wasn't even totally sure that there was the argument was even being brought up until the reply brief when he stated, yes, I am arguing that Linda's contractual rights have been impaired. I think that raises, you know, other issues that I, you know, didn't even consider briefing, such as if there's some standing issues or really diving into the case law regarding a third party or the plan the third party beneficiary's ability to argue that the plan participant's rights have been impaired. However, I would suggest that if this court does decide to entertain that issue, it should still find that the contract clause has not been violated in this case because Linda's contractual rights have not been impaired. Mr. Christensen points to the Whirlpool case. After the Whirlpool case was decided, the Joint Editorial Board of the Uniform Probate Code issued an opinion stating that when you have a government instrument such as the insurance policy in Whirlpool, that policy has both, it's a mixture of contract and domain of transfer components. The contract clause relates to the contract components. All the redesignation statute does is it changes the presumed beneficiary, the presumed lawful beneficiary. Now, looking at the bargain for exchange and then applying the contract clause to the bargain for exchange is apparent in numerous United States Supreme Court cases, including the Blaisdell case, also the GMC versus Roman case, which is a more recent United States Supreme Court contract case. All those cases look to determine whether an enactment, what that effect was on the bargain for exchange. Here, as the editorial board pointed out in its opinion, nothing in Whirlpool suggested that the insurer was released of this obligation to pay the insurance proceeds. Similarly, nobody here is arguing that the South Dakota retirement system was by any way released of any obligation by the redesignation statute to pay the retirement plan assets. Thus, there hasn't been an impairment of any contractual obligation here. The bargain for exchange remains intact, and thus the contract clause has not been invoked, much less violated. Or if the court finds that there is an impairment, the court must then determine the severity of that impairment. It's only a severe impairment that then gets you to the second part of the test. When you look at the severity of the impairment here, the redesignation statute does not completely abrogate Linda's ability to designate a beneficiary. All it does is it presumes or makes a change to who the presumptive lawful beneficiary is. Linda can still go in after the divorce and designate the beneficiary. She can even designate Mr. Storsby as a beneficiary. If you look at the statute and the definition of governing instrument, it's subsection A4. It states that governing instrument means a will, trust, or other governing instrument executed by the divorced individual before the divorce or annulment of the individual's marriage to the former spouse. Thus, if she goes in after the divorce and redesignates Mr. Storsby, that's perfectly permissible and the statute does not apply. Basically, because she is still able to designate a beneficiary, there has been no impairment, or if so, any impairment is not severe. Also, if you look at United States Supreme Court contract clause precedent, including Ally Steel, Energy Reserves, Exxon Corporation, even GMC versus Roman, when determining the severity of the impairment, you look at the party's expectations at the time that the contract is executed. And in doing that, you look at whether the legislature had previously regulated or enacted legislation touching that area of law. Here, in 1971, when Linda executed the retirement plan, the South Dakota legislature clearly regulated the South Dakota retirement system and South Dakota retirement plans. Furthermore, you can find statutes that regulate the disposition of assets upon death back to territorial days. Thus, expectation would be that the legislature could enact statutes that could possibly impair a contractual right. Thus, you do not get to the level of a severe impairment, considering that that is the expectations. Again, however, if the court does find that there is a severe and substantial impairment, the test isn't over. Basically, then the court must apply a level of scrutiny to the statute to determine if it passes constitutional muster. The level of scrutiny is similar to a rational basis standard of review. Basically, the court must look at the statute and determine if that statute is reasonably related to achieve a legitimate and significant public purpose. Now, furthermore, the statute is to, or the court is to give great deference to the legislature in determining what is appropriate and necessary in achieving that legitimate purpose. Thus, you have a similar standard of scrutiny as you have in the rational basis standard review. I will mention that there are some cases out there that state that when a state is a party to a contract, do not give great deference to the legislature, and thus a higher level of scrutiny is applied. However, that language is really misconstrued. I think the first point in any contract clause precedent that you see a heightened standard of review comes in United States Trust Company of New York versus New Jersey. And in that case, United States Supreme Court did apply a higher level of scrutiny, but only because the state had enacted a statute that would override a former statute, and thus they would not have to take money received from a certain fee for a toll on a bridge and provide that to bondholders that the state had contracted with. Rather, the state could retain that money and use it for other funds. The court found that not only was the state a party to that contract, but the state had a self-interest or a self-stake in that contract. Here, this is nothing similar to the United States Trust Company case, where this redesignation statute is anyway allowing the South Dakota legislature to allow the state to retain the assets in Linda's retirement account. Thus, the lower rational basis level of scrutiny is to be applied. I guess in summing up, the Girard case doesn't apply. The redesignation statute clearly applies in this case. There is no prohibition against retroactivity in this case, as the legislature expressly intended it to be retroactive, and there's no impairment of a vested right. Furthermore, the express terms exception has not been invoked. Also, the contract clause, as it relates to Mr. Storsby, has basically unarguable considering prior case law. He only had a beneficiary interest, thus no vested right. The contract clause argument in regards to Linda's impairment of contractual rights has not been raised till the first time on appeal. And even if it has, for the reasons stated, it is not a violation of the contract clause.
I have a question. Or the concern, I understand that the South Dakota Retirement System advised Linda on an annual statement that her designated primary beneficiary was Mr. Storvesy until 1996. And isn't that an indication that... and then in addition, when she passed away, I understand South Dakota Retirement System informed Storvesy that he was the named beneficiary on Linda's retirement plan. Isn't that a pretty strong indication that she, you know, had to look at it every year and consider it up until her death and never change it?
Why? I respectfully think that's making a lot of assumptions, that she actually reviewed it very carefully and recognized that. And, I mean, we don't know exactly what was going through her mind. I think this legislative enactment is the intent that people forget about this thing. They don't think about it. And furthermore, when you apply the statute, there's the three exceptions that apply. None of the sections exceptions have been invoked here. And thus, I think the redesignation statute applies.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Christensen, you have 10 minutes, sir.
As far as the issue about whether we have the right to raise this on appeal, I just want to clarify some things. When the court looks at the transcript of the motion hearing on page 6. I had appeared and have appeared before this trial court many, many times and did not expect him to render a decision from the bench. I expected him to ask some questions and then have us brief that. And so when he that morning said, we're going to resolve it today, I said, the court's comment that it might get resolved today leads me to add this, that I just received Mr. Wild's response brief yesterday. Whether the court grants me 10 days to respond or whether I should do that now, there is a constitutional issue. And for appellant reasons, I want to make sure that that's in the record. And then at the end of the hearing, after I had said, and Mr. Wild takes my comment about having nothing further to add, that's after a lot had been added, but in any event, Judge Johnson said, I will treat the constitutional issue as having been raised at the trial level, even though it was not briefed. So if you want to take it upstairs, as far as I'm concerned, that issue's been raised.
Since this obviously has statewide ramifications, did you comply with the statute and notify the Attorney General of your constitutional challenge?
No.
But Assistant Attorney General Mr. Hubbard did receive copy of your brief and everything, so in a sense, the Attorney General did get it through their Assistant Attorney General.
Yes, and he appeared at the hearing, and he initially had a motion to dismiss, which he voluntarily withdrew, so that the South Dakota Retirement System stayed in the case. I understand the argument that Harold Storsvi might not have had a vested interest in the insurance. However, Linda certainly had a vested interest. She had a vested interest.
Do you have standing to do you have standing to assert her contractual right?
I believe I do from the constitutional basis that one of the things that makes laws which interfere with contractual obligations unconstitutional is that someone has to have a vested interest in that, and it doesn't have to be my client. As far as the legislature knowing what it was doing, all I can say about that is South Dakota Retirement System planned to pay the money over to my client in 2006, 11 years after the legislature had passed this statute tucked into the Uniform Probate Code.
Did they, or did they just advise him that, you know, he may have a claim because he's the named beneficiary?
I don't want to mislead the court on that. I don't have that letter with me, but I know that it was Mr. Buckles who brought the declaratory judgment because he was obviously concerned that they were going to pay the benefits to my client. I didn't bring the declaratory judgment to stop them from paying her husband. As far as all the discussion about the impairment, and it has to be a significant impairment, I guess my position is that if I designate you to receive my insurance or pension plan, it doesn't matter, benefits upon my death, but they go to him, that is a significant impairment. It's just changing everything. So I think that probably, and I want to comment a little bit on Justice Saber's question, because to me it is significant that she had 31 years. In my experience, one thing people pay attention to is money. That seems to be something everybody pays attention to, whether it's an insurance contract or my retirement benefit. Sometimes that's the biggest part of their estate. She gets an annual report for over 20 years that says your beneficiary is your ex-husband. And then, for some reason, starting in 1995, they quit putting the designated beneficiary on the form. But 20 years looking at it, probably the largest.
Were there ever any depositions or anything that from South Dakota Retirement System employees as to why they quit doing that in 1966?
No, and that brings me to really thank you for that question, because I've sort of struggled with it. It seems kind of piggish on my part to say that I would be entitled to summary judgment, but they wouldn't be. But one of the reasons that I'm making that point is that intent, like fraud, is particularly ill-suited for summary judgment. For Judge Johnson to decide that Mr. Buckles prevails, he has to decide that there's no genuine issue of material fact. We submit that there is certainly a genuine issue on that, and at the very least it should be remanded so that that issue can be determined. Why it isn't stopping us from having the court simply reverse it is that she designated my client. It's in writing. I don't know how more you can express your intent. And then when you take the Girard case, the only thing that is in our way is the redistribution statute, which they're passing back 20-some years. It's just too much, Big Brother. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., where we will hear the rules hearing, and then reconvene Thursday morning for three more oral arguments. The court is in recess.